if we have a position such that other people could approach us to get, you know, this privilege over and above everyone else, then obviously the onus is on us to follow the rules and to be sincere and be honest and sort of obviously just say to them, well, no, that's against rules. We don't do that. That is unfair. And obviously we know that in Islam, fairness and justice are, in a sense, our guiding principles, and honesty. So three things there that are really important. And the other, we see this one famous example, from the life of our maybe very famous martyr of service. Usually we talk about the martyrs for holy defense, but one of our very famous martyr of service, the former president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Shahid Raisi, he, when he was very young, received a phone call. He was a prosecutor outside Tehran. He received a phone call for a prisoner to sort of be released, and he just sort of said, "No, that's against the law. That's not permitted." And yeah, so these are the traits that we really need to develop in us to reject nepotism, and this also leads to sort of corruption, and we see that maybe in some governments around the world. There's also you've probably heard of cases around the world where maybe people have high official posts and then they sort of try to get extra benefits for themselves, even. For example, I heard of a story where one government official was, for example, using, I think, one of the government helicopters to go to a private wedding. So these sorts of things could be anything. So let's just make sure we really are on the straight path and are as honest and just and fair as possible, inshallah. So I trust that this is a reminder for all of us, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah, صلي على المصطفى الهادي المجتبى والآل الكرام. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah, صلي على المصطفى الهادي المجتبى والآل الكرام. Don't you worry, follow the sign, leave the story to the divine. Free yourself and say what's true. Be yourself though you may be few. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Al-Kiram. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Al-Kiram. You can see straight into my soul. You know in hardship I changed my goals. Now I realize I was so unwise. Abandoned your advice, faced with your pride. Help was always near if we persevered. If we held up just for a while. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Ali al-Kiram. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Allah, Allah, ya Allah. Salli ala al-Mustafa, al-Hadi, al-Mujtaba, wal-Ali al-Kiram. My life is empty without you. Nothing I've gained is without you. If you are pleased, my soul can breathe. Where would I be without you?
we've been here to the United States a lot. We used to come every year for a vacation, and we really liked the U.S. We saw it's a great country.
This is a huge country. This is a beautiful country. This country is country for everybody.
That's why we decided we wanted to continue our life and move here to the U.S. and have a future here in the U.S.
The Megaheads are the perfect picture of an American immigrant family. Samir Megahed, an engineer, moved from Egypt with his wife and four children to a quiet cul-de-sac in Tampa, Florida, in 1998. Samir found work and his eldest sons followed in his footsteps pursuing engineering degrees. In 2009, the family celebrated becoming American citizens. But their son Yusuf was missing.
My friend told us, how is Yusuf? We told him, he's fine. He went to a beach trip with some of his friends. He told us, did you see CNN? And we were amazed that he was telling us to check Yusuf on CNN.
In August 2007, Yusuf Megahed was on a road trip with his college friend Mohammed, visiting beaches in the south. They were pulled over for driving 60 in a 45-mile-an-hour zone in the small South Carolina town of Goose Creek. But when Mohammed told the officers he had homemade fireworks in the car, they were both arrested and charged with transporting explosives across state lines.
We saw this as a mistake that will hopefully will be solved by the next day. But then the story didn't end the next day, and it continued now for almost 2 years. He was arrested with fireworks. If any white kid or anyone who's not a Middle Eastern would be stopped by a police officer and he would have fireworks, they would consider this to be something ordinary, and they are going to the beach and they are having some fun. But for a Middle Eastern, even this legal stuff that is enjoyed or allowed for any person living here in the U.S., it's considered to be banned or illegal for him. So I think it was almost like a wake-up call that like Arabs and Middle Easterns and people from an Islamic background, they don't enjoy the same rights or same freedoms offered to other people here in the U.S.
Although no formal charges of terrorism were ever filed, Yusuf was held for 10 months in solitary confinement. It was over a year and a half before his trial began.
In the past 2 years, our life is changed completely. It looks like a nightmare. You live under pressure from the biggest government all over the world. If the biggest government all over the world targeting your son, and you know your son is innocent, you're thinking it's crazy. Because Yusuf has a Middle East face and he's carrying Quran, his suspicion on him.
Justify their hatred.
Stop all Muslim immigration. Is that the best way to protect America and our economy from new terror attacks?
The fact of the matter is, these guys want to kill us. We have to fight them. And we have to support law enforcement who want to fight
them.
You know, Clinton goes all over the map here. We got to get these guys before they kill
innocent people. And that's got to be the last
word. If you are an 18 to 28-year-old Muslim man, then you should be strip searched.
So there's always confusion about Islam. Is it a religion of violence or peace?
Islam is a violent, I was going to say religion, but it's not a religion. It's a political system. It's a violent political system bent on the overthrow of the governments of the world and world domination.
In the years since the September 11th attacks, advocacy groups claim that the United States has witnessed an anti-Muslim and anti-Arab backlash. Issam Zayem is president of the Cleveland office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. Nationally, CARE has tracked a five-fold surge in civil rights complaints by Muslim Americans since 2001.
The atmosphere and the environment and the media had created a very false perception about Islam and Muslims, especially American Muslims. So we were all lumped in the categories of the fifth column or the terrorists. If you look into the major cities in the country, you will find that there has been major cases all over the country.
The Department of Justice is waging a deliberate campaign of arrest and detention to protect American lives. We're removing suspected terrorists who violate the law from our streets to prevent further terrorist attack. We believe we have Al-Qaeda membership in custody, and we will use every constitutional tool to keep suspected terrorists locked up.
The U.S. Department of Justice refuses to release a tally of how many people it has detained since the beginning of its so-called war on terror. From 2001 to 2003 alone, however, at least 27,000 Arabs and Muslims inside the United States were detained and interrogated by the FBI, and 7,000 arrested. 145,000 Arab and Muslim immigrants were questioned as part of a special registration program, and of those, nearly 14,000 had deportation proceedings started against them. Sami Hammoudi was a PhD student in applied anthropology and an instructor at the University of South Florida, the same university Youssef Megahed attended as an engineering student. He and his family had moved to Tampa from Palestine in 1992, so Sami could pursue his studies. In 2003, he was arrested as a co-conspirator in the Sami Al-Aryan case and charged with terrorism.
Today, the United States Department of Justice is announcing the indictment of Sami Al-Aryan and seven co-conspirators. All of the defendants, if convicted, face the potential of life sentences. Al-Aryan's U.S. associates and Palestinian Islamic Jihad members arrested today include Sami Hammoudi.
At the very beginning of the case, I thought that there are misunderstandings.
They came around 4 a.m., 4 in the morning. They just came knocking on the door very strongly, and my wife woke up and we opened the door. Then they came to me and said, "You are under arrest for charges of terrorism, for supporting terrorism."
Rabia Haddad came to the U.S. to study in 1980, fleeing the violent civil war in Lebanon. After a career with various aid organizations, in 1992, Haddad founded the Global Relief Foundation, or GRF. It became the second largest Islamic charity in the United States, providing aid to 680,000 people worldwide. In 2001, he was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, with his wife and four young children. He worked as the chairman of GRF and volunteered as an imam at the local mosque. 3 months after 9/11, the government designated his charity a terrorist entity.
They raided our offices December 14th. It was a Friday. And I remember coming home after the Friday prayer. I felt that I was being followed coming back from the mosque. But I didn't think, you know, I thought, well, if they're raiding our offices in Chicago, it's, I think, normal to put me under surveillance, or, you know, whatever. But then maybe an hour after that, they knocked at my door and arrested me. And things went downhill from there.
The theory that gave, let's say, legitimacy to all in their thought, to all of these actions was Muslims and Arabs are either terrorists or potential terrorists. So we have to do things to control these communities. And this is what they did. And this is what they are still doing. Nothing changed.
Back in Tampa, Youssef's court-appointed lawyer, Adam Allen, worried that the prevailing political and media climate would make his case nearly impossible to win.
Initially, obviously, when you are appointed to represent somebody from the Middle East originally, who is charged with the transportation of explosive materials. As a defense lawyer, you have some great concerns about the ability to successfully represent this individual. The media reaction was that this was some sort of terrorist-related activity. The United States Attorney's Office, although not saying that, certainly wasn't saying it wasn't. And that sort of swelled around this case.
Gary Meringer served as the foreman of the jury in Youssef Megahed's trial. He says the tone for the trial was set on the very first day.
The judge asked does anybody here consider themselves an expert with explosives? And then, and he followed that with, is anybody here fluent in Arabic? And not knowing at all, when you go into being paneled on a jury, you don't know anything about the case, just some person sitting there in a business suit, and all of a sudden I'm hearing Arabs and explosives, and it's like, whoa.
I mean, if you ask the man on the street, hey, the defendant's from the Middle East, and he's the government's alleging he's got explosive materials in his trunk, all of my colleagues said, there's no way you're going to win this at trial.
We listened to almost two full weeks of evidence. 40-plus witnesses were put on by the government. I don't know how many documents. It was, I think, over 100.
As the evidence came in, and it kept pointing away from Yusuf, and it kept showing that, you know, if even though there was no physical evidence tying him to it, once it became clear that these items were completely harmless, I felt we should win at trial, and we could win at trial.
The jury, after 3 days of looking hard and fast at the evidence, said, you know, it's the burden of the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was in possession of these materials and that he knew it. It's not sufficient that you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're not guilty of a crime in this country. And there was, the feeling was, you know, there really wasn't any evidence of that.
When the verdict was not guilty, it was a wonderful feeling. There were tears from the client and the family, and probably the best hug I've ever received from my client's father. Several of the agents that worked for the FBI came up and congratulated us and told us that they were not dissatisfied with the verdict in the case. And it was good to know. And I think I was even quoted in the paper as saying, you know, the system worked. As a lawyer who tries cases and understands the Constitution and the purpose of jury trials and the whole notion that the jury is the true representation of our government, it's a check on our government, and it's what makes us America, is that it's not the government that decides whether somebody's guilty, it's the community, because we are government of the people. And the people in this case, despite all the government's best efforts, said, you know what, you're wrong. It was about one of the proudest days I've ever had as a lawyer professionally. It was wonderful.
We went in and talked to the judge. He counseled us never to talk to anybody ever again about anything that had happened. And as a result of that, we all took all of our notes and all the charts and everything, and we just gave them to the bailiff to shred and burn, and thinking we would never, ever revisit this.
Well, he was acquitted of federal explosives charges just this past Friday, but today Yusuf Megahed is back in the hands of federal agents, and his family tonight is outraged.
On Friday, after a three-week trial, Yusuf Megahed walked out of a Tampa courthouse a free man.
I'm very happy.
Megahed was acquitted on all counts of federal explosives charges, but his freedom was short-lived. Monday, to the surprise of his father, Megahed was arrested all over again.
They arrest my son. They kidnap my son.
Samir Megahed, Yusuf's father, says they were walking out of this Walmart on Bruce B. Downs when more than a dozen customs enforcement agents surrounded them.
They separated between me and my son, and they surrounded me. I tried to use the telephone. They didn't allow me to use the telephone. And put the Yusuf in a small car. I tried to stop in front of this car to let Yusuf to speak to his lawyer. They didn't allow me to do this thing. They kidnapped my son.
I would have personally walked into wherever he needed to be, but instead they chose to surveil him for days after the trial and to arrest him and his father as they are walking out of a grocery store, and to surround them by cars and agents and whisk him away in a vehicle.
Tuesday morning, I got to work. I opened up my browser, pulled up the news, and I saw that Yusuf had been arrested on Monday at a Walmart with his dad by immigration authorities. And this has only happened, and I was thinking about this morning, when I saw the Grand Canyon was another example, but where the air got sucked out of my lungs. I read the story and I was like, like that. It just was so improbable. after all the time we had spent to find out that he hadn't done anything.
I spend a lot of my time telling the government they're wrong. That's what federal public defenders do. We tell the government they're wrong, and we argue that they're wrong, and we argue what they're trying to do to our clients is wrong. But we respect the system, and we were a part of the system, and we believe in the system. At that moment in time, not only did I not want to be a part of the system, but I didn't want to be in America. I was no longer proud of our system, and I was certainly not proud of our government.
Many a time, you know, I'd be sitting in my cell all alone, and I would have this slit in the wall that was about maybe 5 inches wide. That was the only window to the outside world. I would only see shadows and, you know, the colors of the sunset, but never really the sun. And I would sit there and wonder if I'm ever going to see a sunset again.
Of course, to this day, not a single charge has been filed against GRF or against any of the employees of GRF, including myself.
I was acquitted from all charges, and in the media, the jurors were saying that we didn't know why they brought him to the case. They took the first decision in half an hour. They voted without any discussion that I was innocent of all charges.
They didn't have enough to bring criminal charges, to charge me as a criminal, as a terrorist. The only accusation they would make against me is that I had overstayed my visa.
I was acquitted. The second day in the morning, ICE came. My attorney asked the judge to release me, but the judge wouldn't accept that.
The lawyer had told them that, like, he should be out in, like, 2 or 3 days just until they process the paperwork and everything. And we kept waiting, and then they transferred him to the immigration facility. And every time we would keep trying, like, for the first, I think, week or two, like, even, like, my dad's lawyer couldn't get any information on what's going on. It wasn't something that was, like, unheard of, and it wasn't something like that I thought couldn't ever happen, because I saw it happen, or I've heard of it happening, but it was just, I didn't expect it to happen to my father.
I was denied bond based on the fact that they considered me a danger to the community, when my whole community was actually demonstrating and protesting and what have you. And they were treating me like the most dangerous, worst criminal ever. When I was taken from my cell to my first immigration hearing, the security they had was unbelievable. They had a sheriff's deputy stationed almost every 10 feet all the way from the door of my cell to the building almost next door. My trial was behind closed doors. I was put in solitary confinement on a floor all by myself in a very tight cell. And they had a camera fixed right on me. The cell door had a small window, and the camera was right there. It was clear then that this wasn't about immigration or me overstaying my visa or anything like that. They were going after me with everything they got.
One time I passed through the room, observation room of the guard, and I saw my picture there. So I asked one of the guards why my picture is there. He said, because you are a threat, and we have to keep an eye over you for 24 hours. And this was from ICE. They gave them this information.
The thing that got to me the most was just not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing whether I'll be able to see him again, whether he'll, you know, just be there for, like, these major events in our lives.
Very quickly, we presented to ICE that I have a passport, I don't need a visa. I can go tomorrow to my country, and I am willing to do that. They said, no, we have to wait.
He'll try appealing, and then there would be different court dates, and, like, nothing would come out of it, and then different promises, and then At the end, they told us, if you just leave voluntarily, we promised he'll be on the flight with you. We kept expecting to find my father there, and he didn't show up. At the end, the immigration officer, he told him, he's like, I can't respond to your questions anymore.
After almost 3 years in prison, two of those in solitary confinement, Sami Hammoudi was found innocent of all terrorism charges. But instead of being released, he was transferred to an immigration jail. For 6 months, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, refused to either release or deport him, even after he agreed to voluntary deportation to reunite with his family. Hammoudi's lawyers brought ICE to court. 2 days before the trial, Hammoudi was deported in secret.
So on the 23rd, they took me to the airport and deported me. So it wasn't their plan to deport me this way. If we didn't go to the federal judge and ask him to either release me or deport me, they wouldn't do that.
We didn't even know, because we were used to him calling, and then he didn't call for 2 days, so we didn't know what was going on. And my mom called his lawyer, and he didn't like have an idea of what's going on, and we kept trying to get in touch with people. And like, she was kind of freaking out, because it was just, you couldn't get in touch with him. No one knew what was happening to him.
It's the humiliation of, you know, being deported and traveling in a t-shirt and sweatpants and prison shoes and having these agents with you. It's especially for somebody who has my good name and my reputation are the only assets I have in this world. I mean, you know, I don't have any money in any bank accounts. I don't have any land. I don't have any. But this is the only thing I have. And the U.S. government made sure to attack me on these two. They have ruined my reputation. They have ruined my good name. And they have accused me unjustly of things that are complete fabrications. They could not prove anything because there was nothing there. But with the USA Patriot Act, they didn't have to prove anything. It was enough for the government to say, we suspect.
They think that accusing people, destroying their lives, is something they can do. This is what worries me. It is the arrogance of the powerful.
Sometimes I think back and I don't even know. Like, it still seems like a dream in a way. And I don't really know how we got through all of it. It seems like it was something that even happened to someone else.
America before, I won't say before September 11th, America before the USA Patriot Act was one thing, and after the USA Patriot Act was a completely different country. I will not be exaggerating if I said America today is a police state just like any other third world police states.
It is actually the Dark Ages. It is the mentality of the Dark Ages, where governments could do anything they wanted to do.
In criminal court, the burden of proof is with the prosecution. They would have to make their case. They would have to prove. In immigration, all they have to do is just cast doubt upon them.
They do whatever they want to do. And they have the laws. They have everything they want to lie, even lie.
All these things that you hear about, freedom and, you know, equality and all these other things, it just seemed like more and more of a facade. And it was just, I don't know. Like, the hypocrisy was just kind of overwhelming, and and just having to deal with that uncertainty on a daily basis was just very nerve-wracking and very exhausting. And
a diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Robbana, Robbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
Robbana, Robbana, ya Robbana.
You
were listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be talking about a very interesting topic and addressing a question which is related to a theme which is very central in Islam and has been recurringly mentioned in it. I'm speaking, of course, of the remembrance of God, which in Arabic we call dhikr. Now, the Quran remembers dhikr, or the remembrance of God, as a virtue. By way of example, in one verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following: O you who have faith, do not let your possessions and your children distract you from the remembrance of God. And whoever does that, it is they who are the losers. So, the remembrance of God, therefore, is a virtue, and we have been advised to remember Him. And opposite to this remembrance is neglectfulness, or ghaflat, which is considered one of the vices. In today's program, the question we want to pose today with respect to this topic is, what are the results or consequences or benefits of remembering God? In order to answer this question, we can take inspiration from the many hadiths which have been narrated from the infallibles, alayhim assalam, regarding remembrance of God and the outcomes that result from it, and as well as some of the verses of the Holy Quran. In one verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following: those who have faith and whose hearts find rest in the remembrance of God, look, the hearts find rest in the remembrance of God. This is a very famous verse of the Holy Quran. And it alludes to the psychological benefit of remembering God. And that is that when we remember God, it brings us a state of peace and happiness, and our hearts find tranquility and rest in it. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub is a famous verse of the Holy Quran. So this is one of the benefits of remembering God. In a beautiful hadith, which in a way echoes the same theme that mentioned in the verse we just mentioned, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam has been reported as having said, the remembrance of God is a healing for the hearts. So this hadith it generalizes the same theme mentioned in the verse. The verse mentioned a specific case, and that, for example, remembrance of God, it heals anxiety. Anxiety is kind of one of the psychological maladies. But this prophetic hadith, it kind of generalizes that and says that, well, the remembrance of God is a cure for all, all maladies and all diseases of the soul and of the mind and the psyche, regardless of whether that's anxiety or depression or anything else. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the benefits and results of the remembrance of God in the light of the Quran and Hadith. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
voices in global politics that challenge mainstream narratives and stir debate across ideological lines. They blend scientific training with fierce political conviction, using digital platforms to amplify perspectives often sidelined in Western discourse. My guest today is one such figure, a commentator whose outspoken views on Syria, foreign intervention, and media bias have earned both admiration and criticism. Her journey from science student to geopolitical influencer reflects the power of online activism in shaping public opinion. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Urey. Maram Sousli, also known by her online aliases Syrian Girl and Mimi Alam, is a Syrian-Australian political commentator and media personality. With a background in biophysics and chemistry from the University of Western Australia, she rose to prominence through her YouTube channel and social media platforms, where she shares commentary on the Syrian civil war, US foreign policy, and global geopolitics. Her work has appeared on outlets such as RT, Press TV, and on Mayardeen. Maram Sousli, very good to have you on SORP.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
The pleasure is all mine. Tell me something. What was your experience, Maram, growing up in Damascus before moving to Australia?
Well, I left Damascus when I was very young, and I really remember, what I remember the most is my family was there, and my cousins who I would play with, my aunts, my uncles, my grandparents. And when I left Syria and Damascus, I found myself constantly trying to my hardest to hold on to any memory I had of my family. And so maybe I remember that time with rose-colored glasses, but I used to always think that those were the best years of my life, you know, the first few years, actually.
Can you tell me?
I moved to Australia when I was 7.
And what years were those 7 years?
What years were they?
Yeah.
They were in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s.
And what do you remember from Syria back then as a 7-year-old?
You know, it was very peaceful. It was, you know, we could go to the playground, like the Jahez, the people were happy. You know, and it's not like I haven't been back to Syria since then. I had been back several times. And there's something charming about it that I think is lost now. You know, that old, people might think of it as something that I shouldn't say, but the old Soviet kind of bloc countries, they were quaint. They had their own, like, simple charm about them, not complicated with materialism. And I just, I remember the community the most.
Tell me about what led you to pursue studies in biophysics and chemistry at the University of Western Australia, right?
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know what? I was just very good at chemistry. And I just thought it would be easier, because if I were to have studied political science, then the professor might have a disagreement with me politically, is what I expected. And I thought to myself, you know, they won't be able to fight me if I do science, because who can argue with science?
Right.
They can't argue with me on a political basis. I do love chemistry, and I'm here for the Mustafa Prize, which is in science.
Of course, it's a pleasure to have you.
Yes, thank you. And so, unfortunately, I was wrong about that. It turns out they can definitely still fight you politically, even if you choose science.
Science is your field.
Yes, they can make sure that your career in science is hurt, in spite of it being, you know, it shouldn't involve politics. But that was the basis of my decision, to really, because also the other thing is, I feel like you can not learn science on your own. You really need a teacher. But politics, you can live it and you can breathe it, and it can just be a part of you without having to study it formally. And I like the concept of a Renaissance soul, someone who isn't just one thing. They're everything.
Absolutely. And in a way, I think you made the right choice, because you, by going through science, you kind of build up a sort of background, and you come from the world within to know the world outside. So that's beautiful, you know, kind of the turn from science and from the world within into the outer world. That's very interesting, though, actually. And I'm sure it kind of shaped your perspective into politics and everything.
I think it brought a bit of the scientific method to analysis of politics as well. And sort of when you make a prediction about what's going to happen in the future, you can almost use science in a way. You can use axioms, you know, methods, formulas. Not so rigid, but in a way you can kind of say like an axiom of, in real politic, which I no longer ascribe to, but in real politic, a nation will always do what is in its interest. Of course, I don't believe that to be true anymore. But that is
why is that? That is also very interesting. Why don't you believe in
because
that?
Because I feel that sometimes a nation will not act in the interest of itself or its people, but in the interest of the economic of the individual or the, you know, sometimes people make mistakes as well.
Yeah.
So if a nation does something that is against its own interest, like the U.S., for example, when it basically commits suicide on the altar of Zionism, that doesn't really benefit the American people. So it's kind of, it breaks that real politic axiom down. You have to invent new axioms to explain the world.
I see. All right. Were there moments during your university years that sparked your interest in geopolitics?
To be honest, it started in high school, not in, I think, attended my first pro-Palestine rally at the age of 15. I think that the 9/11 was very radicalizing, because after that there was the war in Afghanistan, followed by the war in Iraq, and I was protesting the war in Afghanistan even as a teenager. And then I was looking for any activists that were protesting the Iraq war as well. So I think that I, by virtue of where I come from and understanding just some things about politics there, I already had a sense of justice that I wanted to follow. It wasn't until, you know, it was from teenagehood to university before I started my YouTube channel.
Right, and tell me something. You were 15, you just said.
Yes.
You know, what was your worldview back then, and how did you come up to the growth of realizing that you had to join in these solidarity movements?
You know, I'm thinking back now. I think I started watching the news when I was about 12, and I felt like I was being lied to. And I feel silly to say this now. At 12, I wrote a letter to the news asking them why they expected us to be so stupid.
Ah.
This was to the Australian news.
Do you remember the specific news story that you wrote about?
I don't. I just remember thinking that you're insulting our intelligence. And yeah, I wrote an email, I think, to them. And it was a tabloid show.
Yeah.
So of course they're going to insult your intelligence. I think it was, Australians would know it as, you know, Channel 9, not the news, but after the news, it's like current affairs. It was current affairs. So I guess from there grew a skepticism about the media and what we're being told, and investigating it myself. And I was, I guess, exposed as well, because, you know, when you're Syrian, you're not alone in Australia. You also have your own community, and you have a Lebanese
diaspora,
Lebanese especially diaspora, and you get exposed to other news, international news, and then you compare, and you understand that there's lies. And I think that feeling of there's people are lying, it just made me angry, and it drove me to act and go to protest.
So that feeling hit you at the very age of 15.
Yeah, 12 to 15.
Tell me something. How long did it take for you to decide to do something about it, to get out of the loop of mainstream media?
It was the war. It was the war in Afghanistan. That's what caused me to...
The so-called war on terror.
Yes. And then when the war in... I just thought it was unjust, and that all these children were being murdered. And America doing it in a way that I thought they had planned. I read that they had plans for the war before 9/11, and so I thought, okay, there's something else going on here. It's not just terrorism that they're filing. There's something else. And then when the war in Iraq started, I had this strong sense that Syria was going to be next.
How so?
Well, of course, there was General Wesley Clark. That said there was 7 countries in 5 years.
Yeah,
but he said that in 2005, 2006. I had that sense in 2003. I could explain it by saying, you know, there was the axis of evil. Although Syria, I don't think was one of them? It was Iran, North Korea, and Iraq.
Yeah.
So it wasn't Syria, but I thought, well, like, obviously... Syria is going to be next, and it made me upset or angry that not more is being done to stop this war in Iraq.
And what were the first steps that you took in order to raise awareness?
Well, look, I was just a teenage girl, so there wasn't much that
I could
do. But
you had social media.
I had social media, but at the time I was completely anonymous online. I only became in the public eye when the war in Syria began. So during...
Back in 2011, right?
Yeah, exactly. So before that, I was very paranoid and anonymous on the internet, but in real life, I would go to protest, I would give leaps at university for students, and I would join activist groups. But all of that, when the internet came about and became another voice for the people and, you know, an alternative to the mainstream media, which had dominated for so long, I realized that there was more power staying inside on the internet than even being outside on the street. That's not always the case, but for some people, and it's for some, like, if you do it in the right way, it can be just as powerful, if not more powerful, than being on the street.
Miami just said that in the very beginning, you were mostly anonymous. I'm curious to know why.
Well, I have a few reasons. Firstly, naturally, privacy and anonymity is a strength in life. And, you know, you're protecting your identity, your family from targeting, from being politically targeted.
Yeah.
But at the time, especially at the start of 2003, the Iraq War, I was concerned about what Australia called sedition laws.
Uh-huh.
And there was sort of a chilling effect. They announced that if you support the Iraqi resistance or any kind of resistance against the U.S. Invasion, then you could be charged with sedition. And sedition means to go against your government.
Yeah. Oh.
So I was worried about that. I think in retrospect, it was a bluff. Like, I didn't have the wisdom at the time as a teenager to understand that.
Well, if you ask me, you had a lot of wisdom. But anyways, tell me something. How did you transition from science into political commentary?
I think I just always had both at the same time. It kind of conflict. Sometimes they work together, especially when the topic of the news is science. For example, the chemical attacks in Syria, which, you know, now if you were to listen to the Turkish news, which was last week, they'll say that the first chemical attack that happened was in Ghouta in 2013, and they will say that, this is like the anniversary of that. But they will completely forget that 6 months before that, there was an attack on a government-held area in Aleppo, for example. And my knowledge of chemistry did help in understanding what was happening, how they were lying, why they were lying, etc. But the two sides of me do compete, and unfortunately the science side has suffered because of the political side. How did I transition? I did an interview one time with a guy called 108 Morris 108. Nice. YouTube has shut him down now, and unfortunately he's passed away. But it went viral, and I realized because it went viral, it was called Al-Qaeda is Al-CIA. And because it went viral, I decided I could do more.
So that was like the kind of a main motivation for you to publicly start and share your views?
It was the war in Syria. I thought, you know what, if this is my identity and my privacy is worth sacrificing to expose the truth about what's happening in Syria. Because
right.
That's my duty to my birth country.
Of course. I want you to expand a little bit about the vision that you had for launching the YouTube channel and adopting the name Syrian Girl.
Well, Syrian Girl was not the name I originally adopted. It was actually given to me by 108 Morris 108, this gentleman that was, he made excellent videos. Unfortunately, YouTube deleted all his interviews and then he passed away. But he gave me an anonymous name because at the beginning I was still trying to maintain some level of anonymity by not revealing my full name. My original name that I wanted to give myself was Partisan Girl. And which means Resistance Girl. And, you know, that sort of, but I was talking about Syria, so it's easy, Syrian Girl. And that is, so he actually advised me to start a channel. I wanted to talk about a topic, and he said, I'm not interested in this topic, you should create your own YouTube channel and talk about it.
Right, and how did your content evolve as the Syrian civil war intensified?
Well, you know, at the beginning it was about breaking.
Did you ever visit Syria during the civil war?
In fact, I visited the year that the last visit was in 2011.
Oh,
yeah.
I see that. So it was the country was already involved with the war, or it was beforehand?
It was the cusp. It was just the cusp of it. So I saw Syria at its most beautiful. And then not since then.
Could you see the turmoil coming?
You know, Libya, obviously. I could see the writing on the wall from Libya. Yes.
I see.
But when I was there before that, because I would visit every year or every 2 years, I would visit, there was no indication. Except for Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera was a big indicator. Too many people were watching it. Too many satellite dishes were open to it. And that I could see had a very negative influence.
Oh.
Yes.
So you think
on society.
It kind of had the effect of mainstream media on this specific topic?
I think that it, especially Al Jazeera in Arabic, had more of a sectarian vibe to it. So that's why I, you know, and Al Arabiya as well. So those two channels on Syrian satellite television, I think that that wasn't a good sign. Also, the president at the time, Bashar al-Assad, he did open up the country because they were demanding this of him in 2009. And he did so by like allowing Facebooks and